Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the excitable voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
I'm always excited, Matthew.
You are excited, but this week you are extra excited because we have the man, the myth, the everything we hope he will be, Stephen Bywater, on the show.
We do. I've spent ages tracking him down. It's taken weeks, but we finally found him. He was cooped away in Mallorca, but we have him on the show.
I love the fact that he was in Mallorca, by the way, because if we could have had the interview in any other way, I wouldn't have wanted it. I love the fact that he's just on his balcony, which he was, by the way, in Mallorca.
It couldn't have been anywhere else. I would have been so disappointed if he was on his sofa at home.
Straight into it?
Let's do it.
Lovely. Well, this week's guest comes from good goalkeeping stock. His grandfather played for Luton, his father played for Halifax. Both played for Rochdale, which is where he started his career, making his debut as a 16-year-old in 1998. He's since won promotions with West Ham, Derby and Sheffield Wednesday, amassing more than 400 appearances over the course of an eventful 21-year career and counting. Stephen Bywater, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Hello. You missed out Burton. I got promotion with Burton as well.
Oh, my apologies. Terrible.
Oh, that's not a good start.
That's an early error.
I was going to say, he prides himself on his attention to detail, so I'm actually quite delighted.
Missed it.
That's poor. I apologise, Stephen. I might have to re-record that. But that's right.
No, you're not allowed.
But still going strong, right? Still counting, still amassing the appearances.
Still keep going. I still pride myself on my fitness. So if I'm fit enough, then someone thinks I'm good enough, then I'll keep playing. And I love the game. I love going into training every day. So yeah, as long as I'm fit, then I'll keep going. If I think that I'm not good enough or I'm not fit enough, then I'll not let anyone down and I'll just move on.
So that motivation you talk about there, how motivated are you as a player still? Are you very much of the mindset that you shall be a number one and that's it? Or is it a case of working hard and then seeing what will be?
I think the game's changed a lot over the last 5-10 years. There's rotations, it's a team game. Because there's more people in the squad and more competition, you just have to see yourself. I think everyone should see themselves as a squad player and be ready to play whenever. You know, that's the attitude I think you should have nowadays and be relaxed and always be prepared to play. So many years ago, it was you were the number one, you will do this and you will play every game, and that's the mentality. You've got to have that certain mentality, but you've also got to be ready for change and ready to come out and go in. Even as a goalkeeper, you know, you have your cup games that you might play in, and gone are the days where the goalkeeper plays every single game. I think it's definitely more of a team game. Over the years, I think the success has been because I've been in environments where it's been a team dressing room. It's not been long, you know, it's gone quick. I've mixed it with different environments, different countries, different managers, and I think that's stands me in good stead for after football, for experience passing on to the young players of in the game nowadays. When I'm in the dressing rooms and the young lads are saying, oh, Stephen, do you want to do this? I say, do you know what? You're the future. Whatever you want to do, I'll help you out. You're the future. And that's my attitude. You know, they're up and coming. How can I help them as much as I can keep going myself?
Nice. Well, we're going to journey through your career in this podcast. A whole load of stories that you've amassed over the years. Your debut in the Premier League, you obviously switched to West Ham from Rochdale. As an 18-year-old, you made your debut February 2000. Shaka Hislop got injured. You came on against Bradford in what turned out to be an utterly bonkers game.
It was incredible, wasn't it?
So Bradford's the lead. West Ham went 2-1 up. Bradford then went 4-2 up. West Ham pulled it back to 5-4. There was the debacle with Paolo Di Canio and Frank Lampard and the penalty. And your debut as an 18-year-old, what do you recall from that game?
I just recall coming out of change rooms literally 2 minutes in and I'm on. And it was surreal. You know, it was, oh my, all right, oh, okay, I'm in. And it was just an incredibly entertaining game. And one of the goals that they scored, and I was looking at the screen and they took a kickoff and it just went past the goal. But honestly, it was just like it was surreal. I was there, but I wasn't there. And the things that were going on with Paolo sitting on the floor and asking to be subbed. At the end of the game, Trevor Sinclair came to me and said, Stephen, we won. That's all that matters. And I went, brilliant. He said, don't matter, you let 4 goals in. We won. That's all that matters to the lads at the end of the day, that they won. But yeah, it was an exciting game. And I just remember thinking, all right, I'm straight on. I literally walked out and I was on.
We had Jimmy Walker actually on the podcast not so long ago. And he mentioned that the game that you were looking at the big screen. Were you genuinely doing that? You were watching the big screen?
Honestly, I was watching the replay of the goal we just scored. I think we made it 4-4. And I was looking at the big screen because West Ham had 2 big screens, one in each corner, and I was watching the goal. on the replay, and the ball literally whizzed past me and whizzed past the post in the kickoff. I think it was Stuart McCall, you know, the midfielder for them, and he literally, from the kickoff, he had a shot, and it bounced past, and I had to play it cool as if, yeah, I knew what I was doing. I can't believe he tried to shoot from there. That's why I'm glad when I go to the ground and they've got small screens and they can't play the replay. I don't think they can play the replays now. You get distracted by the goals, don't you, sometimes?
Did Harry Redknapp pull you up on that when you got in to the changing room afterwards?
No, we were all just buzzing we won. That was, honestly, everyone was just buzzing we won. And I think with everything that happened that day with players and a bit of disagreement on the pitch, and it brought out a lot of character in me, you know. It made me think, yeah, this is what I want to be, what I want to do. And concentration is a big part of the game that you don't see. It's when people make mistakes or people do things of brilliance, it's because they've got the concentration and the ability to do it. But it made me realise I just have to look every minute at the ball.
I wanted to ask you about, and it was around that time, maybe a year or two after, where I met you for the first time, where we were in England, the 21 camp. I can't remember where it was now. I think it was a couple of games that we had. And I was asked about my first memory of you. And my first memory, I don't know if you'll even remember this, was I think I got there slightly late. So I've got into the room. We had a twin room. And I've got in there, and there were two sofas and two TVs, if I remember rightly. And I thought it was a bit odd that this room like had all this extra furniture in there. And it was only then a few hours later you told me it was because you'd gone and stolen a sofa and an extra TV from one of the rooms next door. Do you remember this camp?
I remember the camp. I just remember doing a lot of press-ups in there. I like things to be right. I like things to, you know, I like to accommodate people. And I thought, if I'm sharing a room, they can have their own TV. But no, we try to accommodate everyone, don't I? That's what I try and do. I'm an extremist. There's two people in a room. Why not have a telly each if you can?
There is a video out there, isn't there, of you doing a workout or a warm-up, shall we say, when you were playing for Millwall, and it was at Blackpool. Are you aware that this exists, that you were caught on a tunnel
cam? I've seen that,
You were doing some form of sit-ups and then like some random stretches.
Yeah, just to keep going, It's, I'm always ready. So if you're sat on a bench at Blackpool, you ever been to Blackpool? It's a very, very cold place, that is. So I think I was keeping warm. That's what you have to do, you know, to keep ready. And I don't want to let anyone down. You know, the club I play for, I am passionate about that club. I'm passionate about the people in the ticket sales, the chefs, the everything. I don't want to go onto that pitch and let those people down as well. So if I have to stay ready, I'll stay ready in any way I can. It was in a tunnel, wasn't it? And they had the video recording or something. I was just keeping fit, keeping ready.
Oh, that's good.
Because my manager knows, Nigel Clough knows, that if he has to call upon me in the 82nd minute or the third minute, he knows I can go on and I'll be ready and I won't pull up injured or I won't let him down. I'll give it my best. And that's what I think, if I was a manager, I would want my players to be like. I'd want them to be always ready.
Just to quickly stick on West Ham, obviously Harry Redknapp was the manager that we've already spoken about. I'd forgotten, just from looking through the squads of the time that you were at West Ham, I'd forgotten how mad that squad was that he'd assembled over the course of a few seasons. You had obviously the likes of yourself. There was Neil Ruddock, John Moncur, Jimmy Bullard, Bernard Lama, the French keeper. Those are all quite strong characters.
I remember things like, you know, Neil Ruddock, for his training session, he'd have like, he'd be sat in the sauna with a bin bag on doing a cycling session. That'd be his training session for the day, just to lose weight. The thing is, you learn from them. You absorb everything they do. They were huge characters in the dressing room. And they're all in one dressing room as well. Al Berkovic was there. He was like a strong character, you know. Paolo Wanchope, who's quite quiet, but he had an aura about him. You know, Igor Stimac came. Stuart Pearce was there. You know, big players in the game of football that you actually watched on TV who had success at big clubs. And we get them all in dressing room. You actually feed off them and you learn from them and you learn to be a strong character yourself, because it's not an ego. It's more of a passion to be the best than just to listen to people that want to be positive around them. Everyone was in two changing rooms and there was just a little corridor between the two that you could go from one to the other. So I was in with Frank Lampard, Rio Ferdinand, Joe Cole, Michael Carrick. In the other dressing room was Neil Ruddock, Steve Lomas, John Moncur. You know, all of us mixing together. It was amazing. So I was very lucky. So the people like at my age now, we've got that experience and we actually helped it. You know, when people come in the dressing rooms, we can understand what's needed for them to bond.
Okay, well, just lastly on West Ham, we've already referenced Jimmy Walker. He also told us a story about pitchforks in Steve Lomas's tyres. Do you recall that incident?
Oh, yeah. Do just for a bit of banter, right? He cycled in. He was injured. He cycled into to training every day for a couple of weeks to get fit. And I just thought, for a bit of banter, I'll just let his tyres down on it. I didn't pop him. I just let his tyres down. You know, put your finger in the tyre of the tube of his bike.
Yeah.
And the next day, he said, "Stephen, I know it was you." I said, "Oh, yeah, I was only joking. Did you pump him up?" He said, "Yeah, yeah." So anyway, coming back from training that afternoon, I had a fork in my tyre, right? A fork in my car tyre, yeah? So I've gone, "Oh, Steve, nice banter, good banter. Yeah, I'll change it quickly." So I thought, you know, I'll just change a tyre. You can change a tyre in 2 minutes. Anyway, I go to my boot, and round the other side of my car was another fork in my tyre. I had two punctures. I was gutted. So I had to get the man out to come and fix them. But at the time, I was buzzing because he'd only done one. And when I walked around, I was devastated. I'd gone from, yeah, good banter, to, oh, my God, I'm stuck here. So, yeah, I thought it was funny. But he was always one to top anyone, he was. If he had any banter, he'd go on another level.
Did you get your own back again, or did you leave it at that?
I left it at that one there.
Yeah.
I thought, you know what, I'm a young player, and I've tried my luck here, and I thought, no, I'll leave it. I love that Mondeo as well. I love that Mondeo. It was a blue Mondeo Gear X, and I loved it.
Well, this is all part of the eccentricity that we've discussed, right? And, you know, you say you have spare time to think. You love your fitness. We have to discuss the famous art installation that you put in your back garden once. Do you want to tell our listeners, because some may not be aware, of what you did erect in your back garden?
I thought one day I wanted to be an artist. I promise you, I wanted to do something to... Because when I run, I think, yeah? And all these people that create things, they must think while they're doing it. So I just thought I'd install a... I actually got it craned in, a horse box, and I just started to spray paint everything. But what I didn't realise that it's not cool to be able to be seen from the road. So I was made aware of that and I had to remove it. But do you know what? I thoroughly enjoyed creating. Honestly, if you try and do it, you know, when you draw, I actually draw now on my iPad, and I design things now on my iPad, and it's so therapeutic. I love it. So, yeah, it just keeps your brain active, doesn't it?
The inspiration for this, Stephen, so just to go over it, it was a big horse box. There was a traffic cone there. There was three mattresses. At one point, there was a blow-up doll. There was a high-vis jacket. And obviously, you spray-painted Peace and Love.
There was a portaloo as well. There was a portaloo that had lights on it. I don't think you saw that bit. Proper portaloo on a stand.
What was the inspiration, mate?
What it was a load of stuff that I thought I could put together and just see what it looked like. And it ended up too tall, too big and too bright for everyone else. Because like you say, when I get two TVs and two sofas, I'm trying to accommodate you. I'm just trying to accommodate myself on a bigger scale.
Yeah, true.
At the time. I didn't have kids at the time, so I didn't, you know, my focus was different. I had energy and I had time to do things and I had time to think. And when you think, you think and then you think and then you think and then, you know, it spirals out of control, really. And you end up spraying. Oh, I had masks and everything. I had proper spray masks. Imagine all the equipment I had for that. It was brilliant. And then, do you know what? Some guy actually liked it, and he bought it. So I put the money into there was a charity called Team Pride. So I put it into there then. So it actually worked out really well. So he bought it. He took it away, and I gave the money to charity.
So basically, you just had you went out for a run. You had the inspiration that you wanted to be an artist, and you...
I just thought, what's it like? Yeah. What's it like to try and have a do at art? Because that's what people do, don't they? That's their escapism. Do you know what? Art is different. It wasn't to create something. It was more like to see what it would feel like to do something.
Yeah, there was a blow-up doll. Was that part of it as well?
Everything, yeah. The mattresses. I had everything on there. Do you know what? Someone actually liked it and bought it, which is the best feeling ever. Do you know when you've done something and someone else has appreciated it and it goes to a good cause? It worked out really well, honestly.
We've talked a lot about yoga on this show before. You are quite keen on your yoga. I believe you enjoy cage fighting. You like to keep yourself occupied. There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
Do you know what? In football, people don't realise that your brain lasts longer than your legs. So although you're in a bubble of being a footballer, you have to think that, you know, the brain will last longer than the legs. So you have to keep yourself mentally active. I went for a run last night and then I came back and about 11 o'clock I did some stretching and did some yoga. And the person who got me into it she was phenomenal. She came to Derby County and I think now she works in Formula One and all. She's elite. She did the Ryan Giggs DVD. It was Sarah that did the Ryan Giggs DVD. She actually came into Derby before she became really successful and really big, and gave every individual player their program, and I'm still sticking to that 12 years later.
Talk to me about this cage fighting as well. What's the crack with that? You're quite into MMA and UFC.
I think it's physical chess, to be honest with you. It's physical chess. It's, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is physical chess. I love it. It's something that's a challenge, isn't it? You know, we all need challenges in life. I just think it's brilliant. It's becoming more popular now as well. I was ahead of the game. I was recognising this years and years ago, and now it's so popular that people love it. It's something that's a skill. In 2007, when I said, you know, if it wasn't a footballer, I'd be a cage fighter, I would have gone into that industry because I love it. I love the skill. I love the challenge. So that was like, what, 11 years ago? Mm. Now you're talking Conor McGregor, you're talking Daniel Cormier. He's 38, he's the world champion. You know, he's fit as a fiddle. He's heavyweight and light heavyweight champion of the world. You know, these people, this market, it's massive. You say it 10, 12 years ago, they go, oh, that guy there, he likes UFC, likes cage fighting. Cool, that's a bit brutal, isn't it? No, it's a skill. I'm just ahead of the game. I can't do it now. I'm too old now. It's not for me. You know, it's a sport that you learn now when you're 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And, you know, I don't do that. I'm at a stage of life where I'm too old to start that game. But 11 years ago, I'd have had a right go. But someone wanted me to play football, and I love football, and I wanted to help Derby County. It was a massive club. So, yeah.
You should introduce it on the training ground, Stephen, a bit like Bobby Gould used to do on the training ground.
Yeah,
the circle with the grappling.
Now you say that. Now, I'm hearing that the young lads at Derby County are doing judo. I don't think judo's any good. I think it's a series of moves. But you say that, people are trying to do that, you know. There's boxing in clubs now. There's everything. It's all functional. It's all functional for upper body strength. You know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, it's got core strength. You know, it's all relative. It can all be used to make you a better player on the pitch. And that's a fact. I'm ahead of the game. People should be doing this in their academies. They should be doing an alternative sport that complements what they do on the pitch.
I read a quote from you, actually, which I'm going to read to you now, just on this subject as well, where you said, I get aggressive before games. I normally start getting wound up the night or the morning before. It's weird, but I get angry. Is that all part of it for you?
It's not angry. You know, you can say angry isn't an aggressive. No, it's not. It's you get passionate. You want to be the best you can be. So, you know, we've got three words in our Burton training. It's passion, desire and aggression. You have to have that quality inside you. Otherwise, if you're not going to get up for a game, if you're not going to go for a challenge, don't do it. If you're not going to buzz off going into training and challenge yourself in training every day, don't do it. Go and sit somewhere and do something that gives you a buzz. When I know there's a game coming along, I'm preparing for it physically and mentally. And the day before, you start thinking about ritual now. You know, you start thinking about, if you train on a Friday, you're already thinking about the game on the Saturday. You're thinking what to eat, what to drink. You know, nowadays, it's just throughout the week because there's so many games. But then it was like one game a week. And the Friday, you really did nail down on this Friday night. You know, the feelings, the emotions, your energy. You need to be ready to play. You know, it's competition. It's, you know, when I stop playing football in a few years' time, I want to try and get to 140 at least. I will miss that because going to the 5-a-side with your mates and the 7-a-side with your mates, it's not the same. It can't be. It's not supporters wanting you to win on the line. It's not your career on the line. It's not other people's career. You know, when you step on that pitch, you're representing your teammates, your manager, your staff, your supporters, your chairman, your directors, your ticket sales people, you, everyone. So there's a buzz to that, isn't there? You go play 5-a-side with your mates, it isn't the same. You know, all these vets people, you know, they go and play in Hong Kong and they play all around the world. It isn't the same buzz. So while I'm in it, that's the emotions I get. I get passionate. I want to win. It's another level than people at your 5-a-side and your 11-a-side after work. You're talking levels. So when I say I'm aggressive and I'm angry, it's not, it's passion. I've still got that hunger now to be the best. I'll go for a run tonight. And do you know what? I'll run another 20 minutes because of this conversation.
With this, I was about to say, that's the message that comes through. And I know we've spoke before, and I've always gone massively into a lot of the mindset stuff. We talk about it a lot on this show, actually. And it's always interesting to find out like a common thread between everyone we speak to, because of course you need something in order to get to the very top of your game. And from everything you do, for some of the things that might be considered a bit out there or a little bit different, but everything's got the same theme listening to you, in that you want to be the best at what you do. You're asking yourself that question, how can I be better?
In one house, I didn't want the moles coming into my garden. Mm. You know, the moles from the field. So I corrugated steel my whole perimeter of my garden so I didn't get any moles.
Amazing.
Who does that? I want my garden to be the best garden that it can be. I had a power cut. I bought a big generator that can serve as a hotel. I don't want no power cuts. You know what I mean? That's the things I do, because that's the character I am. I want everything. That's what I want. It's the way I am. I don't want to be in a position where I'm on the back foot.
You know, it's so interesting talking to you. I gave and I'm not to the level that you are. No, not as extreme, certainly not as passionate. But I gave two stories earlier, actually, that are quite recent. So one was, I wanted to beat my dad at chess. I'm pretty good, but he's fantastic. So we were out in America, and bearing in mind we were on holiday, it was we decided we were going to do a best of seven. So night one, he goes two games up. So the second day of the holiday, he's out enjoying the holiday. I spent the whole day in my room researching how I could be fantastic at chess, so that I could be, you know, I wasted days of my holiday. Another one was, I went to the arcade, this is last night, so a day of recording, last night I went to the arcade and I was playing air hockey. And when I play air hockey, I've studied air hockey to make sure that if I play air hockey, I know how tactically to beat anyone I play against. So I would challenge anybody to a game of air hockey. But again, it's because it's that same mentality. What's the point of playing if you're not going to at least try and be the best?
Exactly. You want the best. You want to be the best. You don't want an excuse. You want to look at yourself in the mirror and go, do you know what? I gave it my best. I couldn't have done any more. And then that makes you feel great, doesn't it? It's like when you read Ronaldo's book and a table tennis played with Rio Ferdinand. Did you read that in his book? He got beat by Rio Ferdinand at table tennis. So he went home, bought himself a table tennis, practiced for 2 weeks solid, challenged Rio for a game and beat him. He just wanted to beat him. So he practiced at home for 2 weeks solid. It's in his book. I thought, do you know what? That's why he's the best. He's going to training from start to finish. This is Ronaldo, the best in the world. These characters, these people that are at the top of their game, they're there for a reason. Obviously, natural talent and genetics, but without what they have inside their brain and their heart and their desire, they don't get to the top. There's plenty of people, Rich has seen loads of people, they have all the talent and it's a waste because they think it's too easy. They last 2 minutes in the sport. They last 2 minutes in life. You know, you've got to have a real passion about what you do. It's everything I do, I have a passion for.
You actually just said there as well, Stephen, correct me if I'm wrong, did you say you're going to run extra tonight as a result of doing this podcast?
I will do another 20 minutes run, right, because of this conversation.
Really?
And you might not think 20 minutes is a lot. Yeah, because last night I ran from my place to the bottom of this mountain, right, and I couldn't physically run anymore, so I ran back. So tonight I'm going to try and go halfway up the mountain. If you see the mountain, you'll think, my gosh, 20 minutes, you'll get about 100 yards up there and you'll come down. But yeah, honestly, I'm motivated by things. This conversation here, I will want to be the best. From Richie's story there, from him telling me about his chess, it's not a waste. When he said it's a waste of his day, it wasn't a waste of his day because he was trying to achieve what he wanted to achieve. He wanted to beat his dad. Yeah. So I don't think that was a waste of time. That was just trying to gain knowledge on how to be the best.
Appreciate that. You're the only person to have ever said that, by the way. Everyone else I've told. But this is where it's interesting, right? Because
I understand.
This is it. Everyone you talk to, people have obviously different mentalities about it. Some people will take the mentality of, oh, you're on holiday, you should be out enjoying the sun. It's like, why should you do anything? I actually, like you said, I came away from that. I improved so much during that day. I learned so many different moves, so many different ideas. And it's that love of improvement. I mean, people on this show might know, I've got one tattoo, and the tattoo effectively means continual and never-ending improvement. It's a symbol that means continual and never-ending improvement, because I just think that growth brings such pleasure in whatever it is. If you're growing and you're learning, it brings such pleasure.
I believe in that as well. You know, if people are not trying to grow in technology, we wouldn't have the social media, we wouldn't have anything, would we? You know, we'd be still stuck in the dark ages. That's what I think anyway. So if you don't have growth in every sector, in every part of every human being, then we stay stagnant, don't you?
We'll move on to Derby. You took them up as a number one in 2006-07. You won in the playoff final. I just want to focus on the playoff final interview that you gave afterwards. You mentioned the banter playing cricket in the morning is unbelievable. What's the banter playing cricket?
So we all used to play indoor cricket. Granted, you know, he's a goalkeeper now. He's at Man U. He was so good at spinning it. And Pesh was there bowling. you know, nowadays you sit in the change room and there's a lot of people on the phones. Back then, though, you weren't. You were playing indoor cricket and you'd have, like, slips and people sat there catching, and it was just brilliant. So, yeah, we used to play indoor cricket and it was bonding, though, and we all loved it. Proper, honestly, we loved it. The whole year, we'd play indoor cricket just in the change rooms before training, and we'd get in early to play it. But you had, like, spinner, you had fast pace, you had medium pace. You know, even the new lads that had come in from, like, the foreign lads would get involved, and that's camaraderie, and that's bonding, and that's being a team player.
There was also a moment where you were pelted with some sort of white... Was it flour? Is that what they were chucking at you? What was it that you were getting chucked in your face?
Yeah, it was a Powerade. Because what you had sachets of Powerade. You have, like, you'd open the sachet and you'd pour it, and it looked like salts into a water, and you'd have Powerade. And Seth Johnson put some in my eyes, and my gosh, did that sting. But I didn't care at the time because we'd won. Yeah, I just remember Pesky Salido wiping it with his towel. Honestly, because we shared a room together, me and Pes. At the time, you know, you don't realise how big a character... you know, he was a big character because on nights out, he'd get all the lads together. But now it's the reverse. He's like, he was a senior pro at the time and he was in my room and he would make sure that I was all right and I would make sure he was all right. But his experience and his calmness was phenomenal. And you don't realise it until afterwards that you think, do you know what a room he was for the season and for those big games.
Well, so that was a success with Derby. The next season... was the season in the Premier League a lot of people talk about. 32 league games without a win, one win in total throughout the season, just 11 points, which is a Premier League low. First Premier League club to be relegated in March, only the second in post-war English football history. There was you, there was Roy Carroll, there was Lewis Price. You played in the first half of that season, didn't you? Kept a clean sheet in the only win against Newcastle, and then you moved on loan. How difficult was that season for you and for Derby and the other goalkeepers involved?
Do you know, it wasn't difficult, I'm being honest with you, because when I first signed for Derby, Billy Davis said to me, sat down, we had a meal, and he said, Stephen, this is a 3-year plan, right? So he was thinking, we'll settle, we'll do well, and then we'll go up. And we just went up, because he got a team together that was a proper team, bonding on and off the pitch, and we'd get lucky. You know, it's the lucky teams that go up, and it's the unlucky ones that go down, I feel. And we went up, and it was just too soon. Nobody wanted to come to us because we'd just come up. Nobody wanted to put their reputations as individual players on the line by going to a team that had been newly promoted through the playoffs that didn't have all the experience of other clubs that were going up. So we knew we were up against it from the moment we got promoted, really. So it was more like, you know, just learn from it and enjoy it. And, you know, it was an experience and I didn't find it hard. I just enjoyed it.
Another experience you had prior to your current club, Burton, you played in India with Kerala Blasters, quite a big club in India, tend to attract a lot of big names. Dimitar Berbatov was one recently. How was that year for you over there?
I literally went for Peter Taylor. I went on loan to Gillingham, played under Peter Taylor, and he is a phenomenal guy. Literally, I travelled the world for him, and I did. When he rang me and said he's going to India, would I like to join him? I said yes. I didn't even think about it. I just said yes. I was in Marbella at the time with friends, and I picked up the phone and went, yeah, I'm there. Went home, told my wife, and she went, no problems, do what you want. I said, I'm going, because he's such a proper guy that's the manager, and you can see by his history what he's done in the game. So literally I went there, and living out there wasn't great, being honest, but the actual football, the standard isn't great. When I was playing a few years ago, it was like people in a tax office, people who sell mobile phones, they were all the Indian players that were playing within the team. So you can imagine the standard of the Indian players you're playing with, but you were there to help them. So that was great. You were there to help them. They were really nice people and they wanted to learn. They wanted to be really good footballers. But I wasn't an outfield player. The heat was horrendous. The first 5 minutes was like fast paced and then it just died down. So I just remember the games when there's 80,000 there, there's 20,000 there, there's 100,000, whatever it was all packed out and it was noisy. It was like a carnival. Being honest with you, the fans that I was at Kerala Blasters with were more interested in Sachin Tendulkar, because Sachin Tendulkar owned the actual football club and he would come to the games and we met him individually because he's like a legend out there and what a nice guy he was. He was so interested in every individual person. He was phenomenal. But all the fans, they go there and they just want to see Sachin. They're not bothered about the football. They just want to touch him or see him. He's like a god out there. You wouldn't understand. We got told we're going to a hotel. So going to the hotel, the taxi driver saying, oh, the roads are shut off, the army's here. I said, what's all that about? He said, oh, Sachin's in town. I went, what? I said, they shut all the roads off for him. He went, yes. they literally, he had an army of about 200 men looking after him.
Wow.
They loved him being there. And, you know, I'd take a goal kick, and when the ball went over the halfway line, the fans would cheer. So they just loved being around the carnival kind of thing. They, you know, they're not really educated on football like they are at cricket. So I loved the experience of the playing, but living out there, not for me. The standards, it's, the golfing class was, it was either you were very rich or you had nothing. We stayed in a hotel that literally a yard, a metre boundary outside your hotel, because you were in a big skyscraper hotel and you looked out and literally there was kids and pigs all around like a tit bit, you know, getting food and going to the loo. And it was like a slum literally outside your hotel that you're loading it up in or whatever it is. And you can see this outside your bedroom window. It wasn't good to see. You can't see kids like that. So anyway, I went out to the shop, which is about half an hour away. I got loads of frisbees, loads of footballs, and I took them into this slum area. My gosh. And the security man said, don't ever do that again. I said, I know. I said, I dropped them and ran. Because if you give gifts to people, there was one person. Then next minute, there was 20 people. Then it was 200 people trying to thank you and say thank you and take gifts off you. So I literally just dropped the stuff and ran. And Peter Ramage was with me. And I swear to God, I went in my room and I just looked at them for the next 2 days while I was there. They were all playing football and frisbee with these frisbees that I bought. And I enjoyed that. But there's only so much you can give and only so much you can do. And I didn't like to be in that environment where these kids with absolutely nothing, like literally eating stuff from the floor where these pigs literally next to them. Something should be done to help give people the opportunity to get out of that situation. Because that's no life, I don't think.
Friends in football, I'm just keen to ask you about, because we talk a lot about football being who you know and those relationships being crucial to securing future moves to various clubs, and people tend to stick together. But do true friends in football exist?
I think they do, yeah. Maybe a handful, but I've got a handful of friends that I would call friends. But, you know, Rich knows the script. You're moving from one to another, to another, to another. And, you know, people, you respect everyone in the game because you're all in the same game and you're all trying to be the best you can be. And you respect everyone. But everyone I come across, I like everyone. I, you know, there's not many people I don't like. You know, and people who come across me, when they get to know me, they like me. But, you know, Robbie Savage, I talked to him this morning. He's a genuine friend. Now, Luke Murphy, he won't come running when he lives down the road from there, and he won't come running off-season with me because he knows what I'm like. So he's a friend, though, but he goes missing off-season because he don't want to run with me.
You said Robbie Savage there as well, Stephen. So you're good mates with Robbie Savage. You met him while you were at
Derby.
Very
good, yeah. Yeah, I shared a room with him, and, yeah, he was very, very funny as a character. He was he just has the other on TV. He says it how it is, and he wanted to be the best, and he wanted everyone to like him. And which a lot of people do, and the people who don't, they don't like him, do they? But he speaks from the heart, and he's a genuinely lovely person. And yeah, I spoke to him this morning. He's off somewhere tomorrow. He was just in the gym, and I think the people who he ordered a drink off, he got the wrong order, so he said he had to call me back. So he called me back, and we had a chat, and we catch up. Well, he's around the corner, but he's a nice guy. I'd do anything for him.
I mean, he's a classic example of that, of someone who doesn't necessarily care what people think, because you're right, a lot of people do like Robbie Savage, but then there are a lot of people, especially, and you see that on social media, who severely dislike him and give him a lot of abuse, and he doesn't even ignore them. He sort of goes back and has a bit of a laugh with them, doesn't he?
Oh, he's got time for everyone. People don't see the work he does for charity, the work he does outside of the media. He does a lot. He's so selfless. He's just an amazing person who does more off the media than people realise. And he wants people to like him. He likes it when people like him because he wants to be liked. So he'll just try and interact with anyone, even if they are negative towards him, he'll still want them to like him. So he'll give them the time and he'll give them the respect to answer back whatever they're saying. He's open. You know, he's not closed off. He'll listen to everyone's point and then he'll tell you what his point is. That's what he is.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, I had a year with him at Blackburn. When I went on loan there for that season. So it was, and everything you just said there is exactly, when people ask me about that kind of time, because it was Brad Friedel, Bellamy and Robbie Savage were probably the big characters at that time. And that was it for me with Sav, he's so loud. Like, I remember him just around the place. The energy he had and he was non-stop. Mm. But a lot of it was that he wanted to be loved. And I think the coaching staff...
He wanted to be loved.
Yeah.
I used to laugh because if you're on a table eating with him and someone had to start off a story, he just, halfway through the story, he'd just walk off. And he'd just... he just made me laugh. He wouldn't. It'd be funny the timing about when he'd walk off, or if someone's about to tell a joke, he'd walk off.
Well, because he was because he was disinterested, or he was doing it for being.
No, because he just trying to be funny, just to try and add a bit of humour to the table. He was just really funny, but loving as well. He wasn't meaning to hurt anyone. You know, he was funny.
We're going to touch on Les Seeley. Now, we talk a lot about Les Seeley on this podcast. He crops up a lot on our Twitter feed as well. He was just one of those characters who always stuck with you as a goalkeeper. And he was your goalkeeper coach at West Ham and sadly passed away at the age of 43 after a heart attack. And upon signing for Derby, you chose to wear that number in homage to Les Seeley, right? You wore number 43.
Yeah. When I came from Rochdale, he looked after me like a dad. You know, he'd pick me up, he'd drop me off, you know, I was learning to drive, and he let me drive in the car park of the hotel, you know what I mean? And he just looked after me like a dad. His coaching was really good. It taught you how to be mentally and physically strong, because he was the kind of character that was mentally and physically just horribly strong. You know, and you come across these people who just, you have an aura about them, a presence about them. And he just looked after me. I got on well with his wife. I see his son, Joe, now. I'm really good friends with Joe. I see him. See him all the time where I live now. So I've just had a really good connection with him, and he looked after me. His life was just cut too short. Mm-hmm. I always remember him. Every day I think about him, and that's true, that is, every day, because he inspires me now. Am I doing the right thing? Should I be doing this? Should I be doing that? I like to think a lot. And when I run, I think. And when I sit on my balcony, I think. And I think, what would he say to me?
I mean, I have to say, he was a bit of an enigma in goal, quite eccentric. So do you see similarities in yourself and Les Seeley?
I think all goalkeepers, you've got to have a bit of a character. You've got to have something about you. You are a target for all the goals that you concede. Mm. And he was a character as well. And he was he was a damn good goalkeeper as well. He might help out with the goalkeeping situation, the five-a-side. He was phenomenal. His distribution was phenomenal. And he'd detail it all down. His half-volley kicking was detailed down to where he dropped the ball. And he was just a very detailed character. You didn't see that. If you just saw him play, you wouldn't see detail in how he became a goalkeeper he was. He loved Manchester United. He'd talk about Manchester United. He'd talk about Sir Alex. And he'd talk about they win all the time. And you'd listen to what he was saying about how he won the European Cup. And, you know, Jim Leighton was carried his coffin with us. You know, they got on really well, and he always got on with everyone. He was very much a guy who knew a lot about football and how it worked and how to be the best he could be. I think he was a visionary. He'd see what was happening, how the game would evolve. He was a clever man, but you don't see that. You just saw him as a really good goalkeeper that was a personality.
One of the reasons I got into goalkeeping was him. If I went to the 1990 FA Cup final, Jim Leighton played the first game. He decided to put Les Seeley in for the second game. And he then played the following season and was excellent just before Peter Schmeichel came. But I always remember I had the shirt with the black zigzags coming down the shirt. And he was actually one of the biggest inspirations for me personally as well, in terms of wanting to go into goalkeeping, because he was just such a big character.
He had a presence about him, you know, but he wasn't the biggest. He wasn't, but he was brave. He was commanding. He was no messing about with him. He was commanding in his box, and I think that came across, and his ability was brilliant. I just remember one of the saves he made. There was a picture of him, he clawed it out, and it hit the post. Mm. It was in that black and green zigzag top. There's a guy who makes caps and hats for Manchester United, and he's drawn me an individual picture of him in his green outfit, and I have it in my gym at home. It's a one-off piece, so I just look at that and I can be better. How can I be better?
Stephen, do you know what? That image you're talking about as well, of the save that he made where he clawed it out, I think...
Do you remember?
It may have been from Nigel Clough, you know? That's the save
He clawed it out and he hit the post and he got it out, and it was an unbelievable save. Mm. Do you know what? The gaffer, he does volleys right every day, and his technique is ridiculous. Mm. So every day I do volleys with the gaffer. Not with the lads. Honestly, the lads want to do volleys. I say, nah, I'll go and do the volleys with the gaffer and practice proper. and you can do the volleys over there that'll hit back behind the goal. So, yeah, he had good technique.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, and I remember seeing this, I watched it, it was on like Sunday Supplement or something on Sky, where did you get in a bit of trouble because you spelt out a certain word?
Yeah, I did. But I didn't think at the time, I didn't think spelling something out was actually swearing. It obviously is.
Yeah.
But that's a true word, though. He said, don't be that. Don't be that in life.
Yeah.
Make sure you do things properly.
Yeah.
Make sure if you say something, you can actually do it.
So what happened? You spelt it out on the show. Did they say anything at the time? Yeah. Or was it then afterwards they said,
nothing. Nothing. They didn't say anything at the time. To me, it was done and dusted. You know, I didn't even know what I'd done. I just thought spelling something isn't saying it, which it obviously is to some people. Even after the show, no one contacted me.
Did they not?
No, they didn't say anything to me.
Can't think where I was at the time, but that was quite a... You can imagine the change room. People thought it was hilarious. The lads at football day must have thought it was funny.
I'm just being honest. I'm an honest speaking person, and I honestly didn't think that was swearing, but I honestly said it because it's the truth. Some people, you know, don't speak the truth, or they swerve around. You know, they're very political, aren't they, when they speak? They're trying to swerve. I just tell it as it is. And the question was, what did Les Healy teach you? And he taught me not to be basically one of them in life.
I thought you were going to spell it out again, then.
Can't spell it out again. See, I know he's swearing now. I've learned, you see. I'm educated.
Yeah, there you go. Well, look. Mate, it's been a fantastic podcast. Really appreciate your time. We always finish the podcast with the same question. It's always interesting to get different answers from, you know, all the goalkeepers we've interviewed, all the coaches we've interviewed. Quite a simple question, but what has goalkeeping given you?
Well, goalkeeping gives you options in life, whether it's things to think about, things to do, things to achieve in my future. Being a goalkeeper, the mental capacity you need to have and the physical strength you need to have has set me up for life, and it's given me options in life. I can do whatever I want. So that's what I think it's given me, being a goalkeeper. The mental and physical, everything, to be whoever I want to be and do whatever I want to do after football. So it's given me everything. It's given me options, and options in life is where it's at.
And are you content, Stephen, with how your career has gone? You've obviously played at the highest level. You've won promotions, four promotions, of course, the one with Burton that I didn't mention at the top of the show. There was potential talk of an England call-up at one point in your career. That never panned out. But are you content with how your career has gone?
I love my career. I've still got a few more years. I love my career. It's all down to opinions. It's like anything in life. Your opinion is different to everyone else's opinion. David James told me once, the only opinions that count in the game is your own and the manager you play for. And that's correct. So if people don't want to play you and don't want to pick you, it's not a problem. You just have to be happy with who you are and what the ability level you're at, and people don't want to play you, no problems. And I am super happy because, look, I've had over 20 years in the game. I've got a few more years in the game. Not many people can say that. So it's all about the years in the game. Gary Megson said to me at Sheffield Wednesday, it's years in the game. Just keep going as long as you can. And that's what I'm trying to do. If I'm fit enough and people think I'm good enough, then I'll do it. But if I think myself that my... Listen, I'm not even going to say that because my fitness will always be elite. I'm an elite athlete first and foremost, and that's what everyone should be in football. But as my career, I'm over the moon with how my career's gone. Over the moon. I'm so lucky. So when I get my feet up and I can relax, I can use my brain. And that's what's most important in my life, using my brain. Because it's amazing what you can do with your brain. And for everyone who's listening, thank you for listening to the show. And I'm sorry if I've waffled a bit, and that's it.
Stephen, you've waffled in a brilliant way, 100%. I don't think we'll ever have another podcast like this one. So,
right, so I'm sat on my balcony, right, and I'm watching some guy, like, he's shaving his chest on his balcony over the way. I can't believe it. So I'm doing this interview now. He's shaving his chest. I can't believe it.
No better way to end the podcast. Absolutely brilliant. Stephen,
no,
Bywater,
I promise you.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
He's done me. I've been done by Bywater.
Go on.
The promotions.
Of course.
Unbelievable.
How do you feel?
Do you know what? In my defence, right, and I'm going to hold my hands up, but in my defence, he did get four promotions. He's bang on. But I was stumped by the stats because he came in on loan to Burton. He'd been with Kerala Blasters and he came in on loan. John McLaughlin was the number one, who we now know has gone on to do some impressive things with Sunderland. Remy Matthews was the understudy at the time. He went back to Norwich, his parent club, in January 2016. Mm. And Bywater came in on loan. He didn't play, so I was stumped by the stats.
It's a lovely explanation. Doesn't change anything that you were wrong.
You're right.
It's fine. You know, look, I certainly pride myself on the fact that I've got certain strengths. One of yours is that attention to detail is your thing, and you've received a lot of compliments. So I guess it's only fair that when you get something wrong, which you have, that you say, you own up, you take responsibility, and we just move on.
We will. And you know what? I'm going to hold my hands up, and I'm not going to re-record it. Like you said, I can't re-record it because
I won't.
I'm going to use my NLP powers, and I'm going to banish that memory. I'm going to come back bigger, stronger, and more statistically astute, my friend.
That's the exact attitude you need. When things don't go your way, can you find a way to bounce back? Which I've got a feeling might lead us on to something we're going to talk about shortly.
100%. But first, passion, desire, and aggression were three words that Stephen Bywater used there, which, listen, what a great podcast. The guy, he did live up to his billing because I think he exceeded expectation for me because he's so emotive.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes his mindset even more important as a goalkeeper and probably even stronger as a goalkeeper.
Well, you could hear during the conversation that he became more and more energetic. It started off strong, but by the middle part, you know, he's talking about going for an extra 20-minute run this evening just because of how pumped he was getting as he was talking. But this is what can happen. And this is where you just mentioned NLP, and this is where it's a big part of NLP about state change, how you can change your state in a moment just with your thoughts, by your physiology, by the words that you speak. The more passionate you become about something, it energizes you, and other people can energize you as well. And the way that he spoke, and he fascinates me as a character, there's so much we could talk about right now, but he's got that going on in abundance. The amount of times he used the word passion, the amount of times he talked about being the very best you can be at something. And when you consider it, why not aim to be the best? You know, if you believe that you only live once, why not aim to be the best at what it is that you choose to do? You could listen to the doubts in your mind over and over and over. And by the way, they'll always be there. They'll keep cropping up. You can listen to them. They're not reality. You can choose to listen to whatever you want to choose to listen to. And with him, he keeps it very simple. If he does something, he does it all out. When he was with the club, he loved that club he was with. He gives absolutely everything. And that's why he's had the career he's had.
Yeah, definitely. And I didn't bring this quote up with him. To be fair, there's a lot that we didn't bring up. I kind of feel like we need a Bywater part two. You know what I mean? Maybe a Bywater bonus at some point, because there were so many other stories. There was an incident with some delivery men last year, which is hilarious. And it actually went to court, for the record, completely thrown out. He was 100% not guilty. But that's an interesting story. He very nearly moved to Tottenham.
Yep.
In his career, very nearly went there, so we didn't get a chance to talk.
Well, we didn't touch on
that.
We didn't touch on half the clubs that he was with.
Yeah,
we just didn't have time.
And one of the quotes was the fact that he said a few years ago that he felt like he was the best goalkeeper in the country, and I can relate to that. Well, I can't relate to it. I never played, but I can understand it. Sorry, because I kind of feel the same with Andrew Lonergan. I saw both of them play when they were very young, and I thought at the time these guys are going to go big. And I don't know with goalkeepers, sometimes whether it's a lack of form at the wrong time or an injury at the wrong time or just the wrong club at the wrong time, it never quite gets to the very, very top level. And listen, he played in the Premier League with West Ham, but he never went that level above.
Look, I talk often about luck, and you know, there's a few quotes out there, the harder you work, the luckier you get, all this kind of stuff. But look, I think it plays a part, because you're right. And there was a time, and I remember how good he was. You mentioned Lonners as well. Very, very good. Now, it can be a couple of things. It can be that you have the bad game at the wrong time, or a great game at the right time. Or it can be that you're in the wrong vehicle. You know, and what I mean by that, we see some of the goalkeepers that have ended up... Look, we interviewed Neil Etheridge. What an interesting story. Now, for a period of time, everything was going against him. Wasn't getting his looking at Fulham. Hadn't played much football. Couldn't find a club. Ends up signing at Oldham for next to nothing. Gets his chance at Walsall on peanuts in League One. And suddenly, everything then goes click, 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 and he's in the Premier League. You know, it can go both ways. And I think that it can sometimes be an element of luck or just the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, that being said, he has had an excellent career. I mean, I'll touch on my own experience. I ended up getting man of the match in the debut that I had against Preston, lost 1-0. I remember at about 60 minutes, a shot from distance, I'd gone to catch it, gone through my hands, clipped the bar, grazed the bar and went over. You know, it's a sliding doors moment. What if that ball had gone in? I might never have had a career, let alone, you know, go on and play the number of games I've had. I might never have had a career. Similarly, if I don't make a big mistake in a game against Hull in the playoffs, I might have played in the Premier League as a number one the following season. So you can look at it so many different ways. They've both had brilliant careers. Stephen Bywater, has had a brilliant career, but yes, it could have been slightly better, because when he was at his best, he was, for me, one of the best in the country.
And those sliding doors, by the way, this is another point, to be fair, this is probably another podcast for us to do, but I'm just going to quickly touch on it now. It's that goalkeeper merry-go-round. I don't know whether it's because we're doing this show that it seems more appropriate, more evident, but for me, it's extraordinary, because we've spoken with Jimmy Walker, Tom Heaton, Frankie Fielding and Lee Grant, who all in some way or another have either been connected to Stephen Bywater, whether they came in to replace him, whether they acted as an understudy. So these goalkeepers all seem to cross paths at some stage. And again, I don't know whether it's because we're doing this show and I'm more in tune with goalkeepers, but that doesn't seem to happen as much with outfield players.
You're spot on. And likewise, I mean, a lot of those names you've mentioned, I've then crossed paths with them at some point, whether it's being in Stephen Bywater or an England squad when I was younger. Same with Lee Grant. Tom Heaton via a lot of mutual contacts that we've had over the years. Joe Hart, similarly, a lot of mutual contacts. Goalkeeper coaches that we've had in common, and you get connected because of that. It is such a small network. One of the great things as well, and people won't necessarily know this, is that actually a lot of the guests we're getting on now aren't being driven by you or myself. It's actually people that have come on the podcast that are recommending it to other goalkeepers. So it's only going to get bigger and better. But that just shows the goalkeepers union. It shows exactly that. It is such a tight union. We know what each other's going through, and we want to help each other.
Listen, from the power grid to the art installation. I mean, the power grid was brilliant. The fact that he installed that in his home because he didn't ever want to run out of power. Because
well, the moles.
Completely forgot about the moles. Yeah. And the fact that he's an elite athlete. I love that. I love the fact that he kept talking about that. But yeah, what a guest. Hopefully people will enjoy that. And listen, four promotions, three playoffs. He won two playoffs, lost one.
Yeah.
But if we're going to talk about playoffs, that gives us a lovely little segue into the next point, because this weekend we saw the League Two, League One and Championship playoff finals and some big goalkeeping talking points. Dylan Phillips and Keller Roos.
Obviously not everyone knows this, but I work with a select number of professional goalkeepers and I offer advice, I guess, you know, based on my qualifications in NLP, psychology, the book that I've written, etc. So I offer them different bits of advice. Dylan Phillips, one of the keepers I work with. Now, Dylan, to give you the story, start of this season, he's had a frustrating couple of years at Charlton, had opportunities but never really given a proper run in the side. Started the season, did well, but they brought in Jed Steer from Aston Villa, who ended up playing the first half of the season at Charlton. So Dylan fighting for that opportunity never quite came. Then in January he got his opportunity, and credit to Charlton, they gave him the nod and he kept his place. Even with Chris Maxwell coming in from Preston, he kept his place. Done brilliantly. I think I've only lost one game the second half of the season with him in goal, and he's been fantastic. Comes to the playoff final, 4 minutes in, I was at the game. You know, we'd had a bit of a chat beforehand. We're always in touch, talking about his game and what have you. 4 minutes into the final, the worst possible thing that could happen to a goalkeeper happens. I didn't even see it, by the way. I was at the game. But because there was absolutely no danger, just so happened that one of Dylan's friends was there and we started talking. And all of a sudden, I hear a gasp. I look up and I see the ball's gone in the net. They wouldn't show a replay at Wembley, so I'm then having to text friends to get them to send me the video footage so I could see exactly what had happened. Then obviously I saw what happened and my heart just sank for him, and I thought, is there a worse possible moment for a goalkeeper to be in? You're at Wembley in front of 80,000 people. It's the biggest game of your life that you've ever been involved in. Millions watching at home on TV, and you've just made arguably the biggest error in your life, and you've got another 86 minutes of the game to play. So I'm looking at Dylan and I'm thinking, this is the moment that will define you. Now, are you going to crumble or are you going to bounce back and are you going to show exactly what you're made of? And what I saw for the remainder of the game, even now, it's making my hair stand on end. Like, I was so impressed, so proud of him. Makes a brilliant save down to his left, coming for crosses. Distribution was excellent, and he was just incredibly solid. And that, what I saw yesterday, we're obviously recording the day after the final itself. That, what I saw yesterday, said to me that Dylan Phillips will go on and be a Premier League goalkeeper at some point. He's got the technical attributes. He's got the physical attributes, and I saw yesterday that he's got the mental attributes. To bounce back from that and show the bravery that he did, phenomenal.
I was on radio while the game was going on, and the guys we were recording with were like, blimmin' it, what an error that is. And I watched it again, and by the way, we'll get onto the fact as to whether it was an error or not. Yeah. But I said, this is going to be really important now, because he needs to banish this memory straight away.
So I spoke to him today and I asked him the question. I was like, so go on, what happened after that moment? He goes, well, look, he goes, I was annoyed. He goes, I threw the ball out the net, and then I said to myself, right, nobody else is getting past me today. That's it. It's happened. I'm not going to let, you can have 1,000 shots. You're not scoring past me today. And you could see it. The save he made down to his left. Mm. What a save that was. That was creeping in the corner. He's got down figure two. And that was the bit that impressed me. I could see from his body language instantly that he hadn't let it get to him in a negative fashion. It had galvanized him. You know, we talk about fight or flight a lot, not just on this show, but in life. Like, you're dealt situations, do you crumble? Which could be easy. He could have then felt sorry for himself. They could have gone two down, three down, four down, and just been a day to forget. And that could have been what we remember for years to come, when Charlton was so close to the championship and Dylan made a mistake. No, he dug in and he fought. And we're always given those opportunities, whether it's in goalkeeping or whether it's in life. Every negative thing that happens to you, you're given a choice. Do you fight or do you give in? And he fought, and he fought so hard. And I was obviously watching him really intently. And I was so, I mean, I got emotional watching him. I was so proud of what he did.
Yeah, definitely. And he did chase the game to a certain extent after that. When balls were going off, rather than waiting for the ball boy to throw it back, he was actually running after the ball, because you could tell he was like, right, I need to control this game. And the celebrations afterwards were brilliant, because he was instigating all of that. And sometimes you see with players who've made a mistake, even though their team has won, they sort of shy away from it a bit because they think, maybe I can't get involved. But full credit to him for going, no, yeah, I made an error, but I came back and now I'm going to have it off with these celebrations.
And he did. And he did. It was interesting, the celebrations. He was, in one hand, going up to the fans apologising, and then in the next moment celebrating. And he was doing it over and over again. It was about, then he was leading the little dance, the whole twist and shout thing.
Yeah.
And then the interview he did afterwards as well was hilarious. But that, to me, he's a massive character. We've said it about goalkeepers before on goalkeeping. Look, you can be quiet. It's not one where you have to be loud and brash or anything like that. You don't at all. But when it comes to playing the game, like, please appreciate when something good happens, because it can be very easy to come out after that game. This is what I would have done in my younger days. Even if we'd have won that game, I'd have been going to my goalie coach, oh, but I really messed up bad there, didn't I? Oh, what are people going to say? Oh, da, da, da. Rather than be, do you know what? I've played 30, 40, 50 good games this season. I've given absolutely everything, regardless of whether it was a good game or a bad game, being able to take the positives from it. And Dylan did that. He apologised. He knew it was his fault. We'll talk about that in a sec, but he knew it was his fault. And then he enjoyed what was an incredible day and what has been an incredible season for him, and now they are a championship team again.
Absolutely. So quickly,
yeah,
was it an error from the goalkeeper or the defender or both?
I mean, look, both, but Dylan will hold his hands up. It wasn't a case of him not being able to get there. He could have got there. He's just misjudged the back pass. I don't know why Naby Sarr's passing it back towards the goal. How many times the defender's told not to do that? And obviously he didn't pass it to Dylan. He did put it beside him with quite a bit of pace on it, but I think Dylan was still a little bit slow to react. Maybe misjudged it slightly. Again, imagine, put yourself in that position. It's so hard to do, because very few will ever get the opportunity to do it, where you are suddenly in the biggest moment of your life. You've got 80,000 fans. It's a bit surreal. That's the only way I can describe it, is that you're not quite in your mind at the start of a game, because it is a surreal atmosphere. You will never have dealt with something like that before. And that's the only thing I can explain as to why Dylan hasn't quite reacted to the ball, or why he's misjudged it. I think there might have been a very slight lack of concentration in that moment. But I think, if anything, that moment then woke him up. And then for the next 86 minutes, he was absolutely spot on.
Fast forward 24 hours. Mm. Aston Villa versus Derby County in the Championship playoff final. And Villa win 2-1. The odd goal was basically from an error from Keller Roos.
It was. I mean, I felt for him. Do you know what happened? And it's very like similarities to the day before. He's had about 10 minutes in, there was a poor kick from Keller Roos. The ball's come back, went to clear it, and he dragged it. And in the end, Jack Grealish had a chance. Now, Jack Grealish missed. But it was a similar one to Dylan, where I thought, okay, how are you going to react? I was willing him to show that grit. I wanted to see the body language from him. I wanted to see him get his chest up and to go out there and fight. And I didn't see it, and it hurt, because I'm watching him, and he looked, and I've seen him recently. I watched him at Bristol City a few weeks ago, and he was excellent, and he's surpassed all expectations at the back end of this season, kept some very good goalkeepers out of the team in order to keep his place, but that wasn't him. And the second goal, of course, there was a moment before that he nearly got tackled when he took too long on the ball. But you could see in his face, I could see in his eyes when the camera zoomed in, that he wasn't all there. The pressure had got to him. And that second goal was just a bad decision. The ball's looped up in the air. Look, you know, we're told as a kid, go catch the ball at the highest point. And he's almost gone to catch it like a rugby ball, as opposed to arms outstretched and trying to catch it at its highest point. And in the end, it's a poor goal to concede. And it was costly. Now, he's got a very tough time ahead of him now, because I've been there myself. The season's over now. How do you deal with it? He'll be thinking about that tonight, tomorrow. probably for the next few weeks, but this is a massive test of character for him now. I hope he delves into some of the stuff that I did, which helped me get through that tough time, because he's going to need to, because he's going to go to some dark, lonely, horrible places, and he needs to fight his way through it. Otherwise, it could be a really tough time ahead.
The positives that he can take from this now is that Scott Carson is at Derby County. He went through something very similar for England in that infamous, shall we say, game against Croatia under Steve McClaren, Wally Witherbrolly and all the rest of it. And also Shay Given is a coach there who's one of the best. So he's got two really good sources to go to there.
No, you're right. That's it. He needs good people around him now, because it can be very easy. And again, this isn't just goalkeeping. This is life. It could be very easy for people to go around him and feel sorry for him and show him sympathy and all that. He doesn't need that. Okay, he needs someone around him to basically tell him to, like, look, it's done. You know, you forget about it, you let it go. Now we focus on growing again. Because exactly what I did, when I made the mistake in the playoff semi-final, I then felt sorry for myself. The initial thought that came into my mind was, I've given everything to this game, and what am I getting out of it? You know, I'm getting all this abuse, all this stick. I don't want to be here anymore. Why can't I just do a desk job? 9 to 5. No one's ever going to blame me for that. I'll never get any criticism. My mind went down those roads. Now, that wasn't the road I should have been going down. It should have been a case of, okay, this kind of stuff happens in life. How do you deal with it? This is what defines you. This is where you then fight back and you come back stronger. I didn't do that. It took me probably 18 months, maybe 2 years to deal with it, which 2 years out of a career during your prime, it's quite a long time. This is where Keller Roos, he's got the same decision. He can feel sorry for himself. People will feel sorry for him, thinking they're doing the best for him, giving him sympathy. He doesn't need that. He needs a little bit of education, understanding, and knowing how he can use this to galvanise him. And this might be a story that in 5 years' time he's talking about when he's playing Premier League football week in, week out, and he's a name on everyone's lips. Or he could be a League One, League Two goalkeeper and have a steady career for the next 10 years and be out of the limelight. I'm sure he wants to be a Premier League goalkeeper. He just has to know how to deal with it.
Okay. Well, that's it. That is it for another week. Thank you very much for listening. And remember, if you want to contact us, it's very easy to do so. On Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official, just search GK Union on Facebook, or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. It's the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with GK Icon and Goalkeepers 365.